Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. The Unthanks there, and it's the first choice tonight of my guest on Mystery Train, because on a Sunday night we get someone in to pick the tracks, and that song, The Father's Song, was chosen by Glenn Hansard. Glenn, good to have you in.
How are you, John?
I never thought I'd actually get you in, because you seem to be the world's busiest man. I mean, one minute I see you, you know, maybe on the street, and then the following night you're doing a concert in Los Angeles or something. I wonder how you manage to do such a thing, but you seem quite busy.
We stay busy, you know. I mean, that's kind of what we do, and it's what drives us, and what sort of pushes us forward is that we're always sort of doing on to the next thing. And I guess it's just one's nature if you like to live your life that way. It's been a pretty busy kind of decade, I suppose. Yeah. The last one, and I'm all up for it.
Yeah. See, I met you last at the John Sheehan night, the Luke Kelly tribute evening at Liberty Hall. And you turned up at that and sang and so on. And I said, you were talking about the show, and I said to you, you should do this. Would you do this Sunday night sometime? But not expecting you would actually be able to do it, because it does take 2 hours. I didn't think you'd have 2 hours.
When you asked me to do this, I was like, yes, sir, anytime, wherever you want.
Great. So we're kind of winging it tonight, because, you know, sometimes people come in very prepared. Some people come in a bit prepared. We're not really prepared at all here, are we?
No, we're not. I just got back from Paris, and I was making videos, and I honestly, John, I you know, I was really into coming in on the show, but I had the feeling that between the two of us, we could probably wing it.
We'll wing it.
So yeah. I brought in a couple of CDs.
But the good thing about this is, Glenn, in a sense, I have interviewed you now so many times over the years, and public interviews as well. It's probably better that we don't even go there and just play the records.
Sure.
And see what happens.
100%.
Some of that will inevitably come up. But The Unthanks was your first choice.
Absolutely. And I love the song. And I heard this song, I was listening to FIP, the French national broadcaster, one night in Paris. And this song came on. And just one of those moments where the radio can do this thing, and thank God for the radio, you know, and I don't say that because I'm on it right now, but thank God for a format or a medium that can still completely surprise you. You know, with the cinema, you go to the cinema, you pay your ticket, there's a kind of a, but the radio, it's just on.
Yeah.
And, you know, things flow past you, and occasionally something just goes bam, and you suddenly sit up in the bed, which I did that night, turn up the radio, and time stands still. You find yourself taking out your pen to write down whatever the hell this thing is. And of course, you try to, in French, you try to backtrack on what the presenter is saying, and you get The Unthanks. And then of course, I start trawling through the records to try to find out which one it was.
You've probably worked with them, Glenn, have you, somewhere?
Actually, I've had some contact with them simply because I was so moved by this song that I reached out to them and I asked them, would there be any way that we could do something together? And we did talk about doing a concert together at Sheffield Cathedral, Durham Cathedral, which is interesting because my name Hansard comes from Huguenot, but the Huguenots moved up to the border country in England,
right?
And so apparently Durham Cathedral or Durham Castle is built on the grounds where the Hansard house used to stand. So they were like a big deal, the Hansards, whoever they were, in Durham, which is where they were suggesting to do the gig. And then King Charles II gave Sir Richard Hansard lands in Lifford in Ireland. So somewhere along the line, I'm related to the people of Lifford, because he owned the township of Lifford.
So, Glenn, where did it all go wrong?
I know, stop. I found a Millie Hansard on the Irish, on the census, and she lived in a halfway house in Gardiner Street, which is where my dad was born.
Right.
So I can only imagine that Millie Hansard, whoever she was, God rest her soul, was my great-great-great-grandmother somehow.
But there's landed gentry in there somewhere.
Landed gentry, Normans, and you know, probably somebody on the game, because if you think Gardiner Street, that would have been the Monto. So, you know, it's a very interesting...
Well, we had Paula Meehan in here some months ago, and she was talking about her people and back in the day, and we ended up in the very same bordello that's mentioned in Joyce and Ulysses.
No way.
Yeah, so, you know, that was the same history there too. And she was kind of proud of that history.
Yeah, you know, my mother talks about something. It's amazing. My mother talks about working for a madam when she was a kid. Now, she didn't know she was a madam. She just worked for this woman and all of her daughters. But it turns out all of her daughters were more or less the same age.
Yeah.
And she'd loads of them. And me ma would go shopping for them and go and get them women's things in the chemist. Me ma was only like 12, 13. But she would do all the shopping for this house.
Yeah.
And my granny knew that she was doing it and it was okay. And there was a kind of, me ma was aware that there was a tunnel from Kelly's pub on the corner of Talbot Street that went under and into this madam's house. So it was a kind of a fascinating bit of local history that my mother was kind of part of, you know.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
So your next choice, Glenn. Speaking of your mother, I think I remember you telling me that it was your mother introduced you to Leonard Cohen, was it?
Well, yeah. Well, she introduced us to music, full stop. I mean,
this was you sitting in the sink getting your hair washed and
that's
all that.
Right. Yeah. Well remembered. Yeah. So this song, my brother, on my fifth birthday, I learned this song. And my brother learned The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. And my ma had one of those, you know, open up record players that you plugged in, you know, the suitcase ones, and you just put the needle on. And like a bird on a wire for me was, it was such a beautiful song, because the only time my family ever went to church was Christmas Eve. And it was always, you know, the classic was always the drunk people were at the back of the, were at the back of the church. And so like a drunk in a midnight choir for me spoke of Sligo, Ballymun, the lads down the back, you know, the priest kind of, and you know, it's funny now when I think about it, it's like a singer dealing with a rowdy crowd. The priest had to be good to get, you know, to get Sunday Mass across the line, because, you know, there were people, you know, people
had to give good Mass. Yeah.
You had to give good Mass. Yeah.
All right. Well, this is a bird in the wire. Funny, I used to have the same thought when I heard that song as well. It's very evocative of being a child and being at Mass and wondering why the man beside you might be, there might be a whiff off him.
Yeah, or it could be the priest.
Like a bird on the wire.
Leonard Cohen, Bird in the Wire. The choice of Glenn Hansard is with me in studio tonight. It's hard to beat that, really. We were just saying while that's on, I don't think I've listened to the original version of that, which that is, in so long, because it's probably the most famous song. And sometimes you park those and forget about them.
Yeah.
And then you go back and realise, really good.
Yeah, and sometimes you hear it again, and you hear it again, and you hear a newness in it. And you know, just, I saw a beggar leaning on his wooden crutch. He smiled to me. He said to me, you should not ask for so much. I just think that's such a, you know, and I saw a woman leaning in her darkened door. She smiled to me. Hey, why not ask for more? It's there's something when you go, and again, that Jew's harp just going down, all the way through the song. Like, incredibly courageous recordings that he was making back then. Just, and again, just to come back to that song, for me, it was the first, you know, if there is something of nostalgia in this interview, it's to do with the fact that that was the first song I ever learned. And I think in my mid-30s, I was still figuring out, and I still am now. Mm. In my late 40s, that what the lyrics mean, you know, it just.
Well, you see, that's the thing about when you go back to a song, as well as realizing just how good it was. You also, if you first heard that song at 11 or something, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And I've often gone back to songs that I've known all my life, but I listen to them now and I think, oh, that's what that's about, or that might be what it's about. But I was just in those days probably just impressed by good lyrics, clever lyrics, without understanding them.
Right.
Or even coming close to understanding them. Like Joni Mitchell songs and so on.
Of course.
Oh, you just worked with Joni, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I just saw her again. I played with her on her 70th birthday, which was 5 years ago. And then she asked me to come back and they take part in her 75th.
Yeah.
And it was what an extraordinary experience.
I think it was two songs each everybody got, is that right?
Everybody got two songs.
What did you do?
She picked for me, I asked for Coyote. That was the one that I really wanted, which we could play actually. And then I really, she asked me to do Shadows and Light originally, was the from Hissing of Summerlands, but then I did the Boho Dance.
Yeah.
Which, Jesus, like, I mean, for me, I have to say, like, getting my head around those melodies was incredibly difficult, because I guess I'm sort of thinking I'm rooted in the folk tradition, and where Joni was coming from with the jazz, I mean, I really couldn't find the next note. To me, it was random which one it was. And of course, she had a great understanding of the jazz, the voicing of the jazz. And I really found it difficult. But once I got it, it changed my songwriting. I immediately became kind of more broader in my scope as a writer of music. And so I'm very grateful to her for that. And she wrote me a lovely note after we shared a dressing room in Toronto on her 70th. And I think the only reason she actually chose my dressing room is because she could smoke out the window, because I was at the end of the corridor. And so we ended up sharing a dressing room for 2 days. And it was incredible for me. I just, you know, those moments where you just wish you had a recorder going the whole time, because her brain is so fast. Mm. She's like, but I was telling her a story and I can't even recall what the story was exactly, but I was telling her a story and she said, you know, I like that story. You should rhyme it. And I remember thinking, wow, that's an amazing way of putting it. She said, well, that's what we do. We just rhyme our lives. Rhyme that story. It's a good one. And she said it so flippantly, but yeah. I remember thinking, wow, Joni Mitchell, you just absolutely nailed what it is we do. And what a responsibility to just say, rhyme it. Just rhyme the truth. It's enough, you know.
Wow. And I'm aware of not telling tales out of school and all the rest of it, but how is she? We were all looking at that picture recently of herself and David Hockney. It was the first sort of sighting of her in a while, and she looked pretty well.
You know, it's funny. We were at the gig and we were all nervous because, you know, she came in and nobody wanted to bother her. Because, you know, when she was 70, she arrived in a taxi on her own at the gig. She wandered in, said hello to everybody, came up to my dressing room, parked her bag there and stayed for the 2 days. Whereas this time she arrived in a chair. Everyone was very cautious and nobody really wanted to. And the first person to approach her, I remember, because, you know, there was a lot of ex-lovers and a lot of old friends on that stage.
Graham Nash was there, wasn't
he? Exactly. Yeah. And I remember James Taylor was standing inside the stage and he was like, yeah, this one's about me. You know, I was like, what? You know, Chris Christopherson, who was very delicate right now, and bless him, he's very delicate, you know, on his feet and... He went up to her and right after the show, and he leaned over the, she's in a wheelchair, and he leaned over the chair and he said, Hey, Joni, it's me, it's Chris. And Joni just looks at him and goes, I know. And I just thought, what a lovely, she was as sharp as a tack, you know, and which made us kind of was relieved. Everyone was very relieved and very happy for her, because then we sat down and everybody had dinner and she was rabbiting away. She was great, in great form. But, you know, she was tired and she was delicate, but she, the brain is still 100%.
I know, Glenn, for yourself, you know, your career, particularly since the Oscar and all that, really propelled you into another universe. And within days of that, you were operating in a whole different sphere. But at the same time, surely you're sitting there thinking, what am I doing here with Joni Mitchell and all the rest of them?
Stop. It's an incredibly blessed. I mean, whatever about fame and fortune or this or that or whatever. It's an incredible thing to meet the people who inspired you. That's, you know, that's it. The people that you grew up, I don't know how many people in their lives have those heroes. I'm pretty sure much everybody does. But, you know, what are the chances that you get to spend a bit of time with them, you know, and to talk and to discuss what the magic of what we all do. And, you know, the fact that I have maybe had a conversation with Joni or whatever doesn't make me in any way comparable with Joni. It just means I've been a fortunate man. Yeah. And I have to really mark that difference. It's, you know, just because you get to meet some certain folks doesn't mean you are those folks. It's just a really good thing.
No, but just, I mean, I imagine just looking around the room thinking, you know, even though you've every right to be there, you must be thinking yourself, what am I doing here?
Absolutely. And there does come a point where you sort of go, look, unless you begin to see these people as peers, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, there is a lesson there.
Yeah, you got to step up.
You have to.
Yeah. Let's hear Joni. You mentioned Coyote. We play that
one?
Okay. And that's Joni Mitchell, Coyote. The choice of Glenn Hansard is with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. We've already mentioned Joni and Leonard.
Yeah, I know.
Let's get the others out of the road now while we're at it. There's no Bob in you. You didn't bring any Bob, did you?
I didn't put any Bob in this. I don't know why. I just picked a bunch of music that moves me. I didn't really think about should I represent all of my heroes or anything. Now, we just have now with two songs. But just because we were talking about Joni and the conversation went that way, and the conversation will go that way, I suppose, and that's the way you have to go with it. But no, I brought in a bunch of music, the stuff that I just heard through the years. I was like, oh, wow, I love this tune. What's that? Whoa. You know.
Well, pick one that's completely out of left field here now. Something that's...
Okay.
I mightn't have heard.
I'll pick Gastro del Sol, The Seasons Reverse. This is a song... I remember going to see David Grubbs, who's the main creator of this song, in the Funnel, with some friends of mine, my friend David Cleary and Dunk Murphy from Sunken Foal, years and years ago. And just this guy with a guitar, and he was part of a band called Squirrel Bait. And Squirrel Bait were a part of the Louisville scene, which Slint had come out of. And in around 92, when the Frames had just begun, I was in, what's the record shop that was, Comet Record? No, not the one that was on in Temple Bar, just on the corner. I can't remember the name of it now. Great record shop, but I was in
the
there.
The one that had all the bootleg tapes in it.
The one that had a load of bootleg tapes. Yeah. And I heard this music coming through the speakers, and it was Slint. And I was so knocked out by this weird, odd thing I was hearing. This, like, if sound is colour, this was colour I'd never seen. It was a very deep thing. And so David Grubbs was kind of out of this gang. And when I heard this song, I was just so moved at the tonal quality of it. You'll understand what I mean when you hear it. But it's just, and just this idea that the seasons reverse and his kind of, you know, I guess it's kind of math folk in a sense. But that's saying too much. But it's a
math folk.
It's a beautiful thing.
Seasons reverse. I'll tell you, Claire, I'm going to go out and buy that straight away. I love that.
Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it?
And I missed them somehow, but I know it comes from that whole world of Tortoise and all the rest of them, and John McIntyre and all
that.
Yeah,
Slint and all that gang. Squirrel Bait.
That's great, that.
There was a kind of a real excitement coming out of that part of the world. Chicago, Louisville. I mean, it seemed to be kind of both, you know. But I love this music.
And it's good, you know, just saying as we went through, there's a lot of imagination going on there with someone who's laying down the sonic side of things, thinking about the sonics and thinking about different sounds you can bring in and electronic. And then that mad trumpet appears and you think, this is brilliant. Somebody's really making an effort here to be imaginative.
Yeah, and then the steel drum following.
And on your new record, Len, there's a lot of that kind of imagination going on, leaving aside the singing and the words and the song itself. There's a lot of thought has gone into the musical background. It's not just guitar and piano.
Well, no, I made a conscious decision on this record I met these Persian musicians in Paris, Tree Brothers, the Kosherveh brothers from Iran. And what they were doing was just so interesting to me. It was like the Arabic, I suppose, the Persian melodic line reminded me so much of Irish music. And yet there was a few notes that were just so interestingly off, you know, or on, depending on what way you want to look at. And so it made me think about how Irish music is so influenced by North Africa and I just thought, wow, if I could bring over Brendan Begley and have him sit with the Persian musicians and then bring over Dunk Murphy and Dave Cleary, who are like kind of experimental electronic musicians. And you know, I suppose my what I had asked Dunk and Dave to do was to disrupt my music, just to come in and just disrupt it.
Yeah.
And see where it brought everything. And those guys are just, they're incredible musicians. So with the Persian influence and then the electronic influence and the trad influence, you know, we basically got into an area where I was like, I don't know what this is, but all of the songs that I had brought to the studio are now gone. And we're starting from here because this is, we're onto something here. This is an interesting sound.
Disruption can be a good tactic. You know, when you're trying to make something.
It's for me, you know, it's going to sound like a strange thing to say, but one gets bored with a guy and a guitar. You know, Nico Muley has a nickname for me, which I probably shouldn't say, but I'll say it. It's not, he calls me Ernest Strumming. That's kind of his, you know, cowboy name for me. And I, you know, it's true, you know, because so much of it is about going on stage and really laying into your song and connecting. But sometimes there's space for making music which surprises you and pulls you out of yourself. And I suppose for me with this record, I'm very happy to be, I'm very happy that Glenn Hansard of the kind of singer-songwriter world, because I don't really listen to singer-songwriters. Mm. It's a strange thing. I make that kind of music because that's the kind of music I make, but I don't, it's not the kind of music I necessarily listen to. Now, you know, we've listened to Leonard and, you know, all those guys, but it's not something I keep an eye on in a contemporary sense.
Well, the other thing about your record that I've noticed, Glenn, listening to it, is the vocal is extremely intimate. You're right into the microphone a lot of the time.
Mm.
It's a thing that Lou Reed did. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that Lanois did with Bob Dylan on some of those albums,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Were you thinking about either of those two people, for instance, when you did that, or was that again by letting other people go to town with your songs?
I was thinking, because I'd spent a lot of time in Paris in over the last two and a half years, and I really became aware, listening to a lot of French radio, that the French are really interested in intention.
Yeah.
It's the melodies and all of that are kind of secondary to the intention of the voice. It's got nothing to do with the lyric is really important for the French, of course, but the one thing that ties all the singers together that are beloved, the beloved singers, you know, the Georges Bressons and the Serge Gainsbourgs and the Jacques Brels and Francois Hardys, is the intention in their voice. And so for me, this would be the main influence that France had on this record, is that I was really absorbing a lot of that music and really paying attention to it. So the Serge Gainsbourg vocal sound turns out to be two of these mics pointing this way, one mic pointing this way, and for that super, super dry, super clear. And so in a way, I was just sort of tipping a hat to that world and wanting to make a record where it isn't about me selling the song. It's about me singing something. And as I said, these songs were improvised. And so in the improvisation, I'm not becoming impassioned. I'm just trying to find the lyric or the melody line. And so it's much more laboratory based than it is. And as well paying tribute to the French chansons.
Now, when you say improvised, how much of the recorded finished version is improvised? Or I mean, are you talking about improvising until you get to that point and then you record it?
No, I mean literally. I mean,
really,
the first song on the record, if you listen to the beginning of it, I'm between two takes of two different songs, and I start playing this little riff. Brendan Begley plays a little thing on the accordion, which sounds kind of dissonant, which I really liked. Rosie McKenzie on the violin played a thing, and I remember just thinking, and then Dave Cleary said, I've got a beat that I think would work really well over that. So it was just, we recorded like a minute long thing, but the minute long thing that we recorded is the song. I mean,
right.
That didn't change.
Yeah.
The whole song is just a repeat of that phrase. The chord progression never changes. And Dave Cleary brought in this beat and he said, you know what, it's a deep cut from the Queen Bowie session and for Under Pressure. This beat, no one will ever notice it. It's like a set demo, you know, and classic hip hop thing of like, we can use it, no problem. We went and we used this amazing cassette drum loop, which is at the beginning of the song, I'll Be You Be Me. And of course, played it, loved it. It completely fit. It changed the whole tone of the song. We started laying guitars on it. The whole thing became this quite a sinister, deep kind of a song, which I was really happy about. And I'd hit on this thing of I'll be you, be me, and I'll be you. And I kind of didn't know how to finish that phrase, but that's what I'd had. And it got to the point, we mixed the song, and then a friend of mine was going, you should check out Spotify. I mean, you know, and I've always been kind of against, maybe it's, you know, it's very easy to say I'm of an age group or of a blah, blah. I just like to hold records. I like to look at them. I like CDs. I like to hold it. I like a record in my hands. I'm not really that interested in it being in some ethereal place. But I downloaded Spotify because I heard you could make mixtapes on it.
Yeah.
And that attracted me. The idea that I could make mixtapes and then anyone who liked my music could hear what I was listening to. Oh, that's interesting. So downloaded it, and one of the first songs that came up on Spotify just randomly was this Queen song that has exactly that loop. So we ended up having to knock on the door and go and ask Queen if there was any chance we could use this tune, and it took them ages and ages to get back. And so the record's been pushed back 2 months because Brian May just didn't bother listening to it until he did, and then he said, yeah, sure, go ahead. So thanks to my good friend Dave, that we ended up, the record got pushed back and we ended up having to shell out a load of money to Queen to use the drum beat.
Maybe that's the one we should hear.
Okay,
here it is. There's a lot going on there, Glenn. A lot going on. And that's a song called I'll Be You, Be Me. And it's on the new record. You see, that's what I was talking about. There's the whole sonic thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not at all worried, are you, that the song, the singer-songwriter, the beloved Ernest Strumming, as you said, will somehow get lost in this sonic wonderfulness?
Not at all, because I mean, this is where the frames were most comfortable.
Yeah,
was in this kind of a sound. So really, I mean, Joe Doyle still plays in my band, and I love him. Earl, Graham Hopkins, you know, Cullum, Rob Bochnick. I mean, these guys are the band that I've been in for the last 25 years, you know, or more.
Well, in fact, that sort of about bombast isn't the word, but the noise at the end of that record, it would remind you of the Frames. Right?
Yeah, and it was a real, it was a joyful noise to make, because once the Bowie Queen drum beat came in, suddenly the song had a different tenor, you know. Yeah. And so we were like, oh, what do we do with it? And it's just like, okay, well, let's build it. And then suddenly it was like, I remember all of us looking at each other going, okay, it's time for the skronk. And the skronk is something we always refer to as the moment where it just goes, it turns into this other kind of thing. And so, no, I'm actually really pleased with it. But I think for people who follow my solo work, or people who know who the Frames, people who know anything about the Frames or my history will listen to this and not be surprised at all.
Yeah, yeah. Are you going to tell them where the skronk comes from in that particular song?
Not opening my mouth.
All right. Somebody might notice. And if you do, there's a prize for anybody. You can tell where it comes from. So, next musical choice, Glenn. Let's get into something. We were talking just before that. Sorry, I introduced your record into the conversation there, but we were going to play Arthur Russell, weren't we?
We were.
Which one do you want, That's Us?
Well, you know, That's Us or... let's play I Couldn't Say It To Your Face, because most people who know Arthur Russell would know That's Us, Wild Combination. But this song is just an absolute... You know, sometimes you hear a song and you just go, man, I wish I'd written that tune.
I couldn't say it to your face, but I...
And that's Arthur Russell there, a song called Couldn't Say It To Your Face. Glenn Hansard with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. Arthur Russell is one of those guys who, anybody who knows him, absolutely loves him. But the vast majority of people will never have come across Arthur Russell at all, because he's not quite an outsider artist, but he's certainly outside the mainstream.
One of those guys that influences so many bands and yet has never really sort of been seen in that space. I suppose if you were to play That's Us, Wild Combination, you would definitely get a sense of where he did peek his head into a kind of a world. But I, you know, thank God for the people who just go out there and dig and dig and dig. And it's not really important what they throw up. You know, it's like you're looking down the hole and what's Arthur trying? He's just thrown up something. But it's like often these people throw up stuff that influences.
When he was a cellist.
Yeah, you exactly.
Know? Yeah, those kind of outsider people, Glenn, do you think you would have been content to have been one of those people, do you think?
You know, John, I never had that mentality. It was when I was growing up and when I was coming up. I think there's a kind of a working class thing about proving yourself.
Yeah.
There's something about wanting to make a big splash, to be the biggest, the fastest and the loudest. And that seems to come from people who have very little, more so than it does from people who have plenty.
And it's more than just look at me, ma. There's a bit of that in most rock performers, I think.
100%.
Look at me, I'm good, haven't I?
I'm good, haven't I? Didn't I? Yeah, and as you get over that, you probably get over that in your late 30s.
Yeah. If you're lucky, yeah.
Yeah, then you start focusing on what it is that actually moves you. And then you can kind of, you know, I look at Bruce and I see somebody who's classic, that guy, you know, the... singing to the mother and singing to his father and proving himself. And I love it. It serves his music so well.
He wrote about that very well, didn't he, in the book?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and really well.
Thank God for him, because he really is saying it for a lot of us. You know, he's putting stuff out there that is very, very difficult to touch.
Speaking of outsiders and people who aren't outsiders, I was just saying there that Arthur Russell wasn't quite an outsider, but you've also brought in a record by Yandek. And well, Yandek, I suppose, is considered an outsider artist in lots of ways.
Yeah, Yandek definitely would be considered an outsider. Now, I heard this song in a record shop, again, rifling through the vinyl somewhere in America and in the South. Now, I'm not exactly sure what town it was, but I remember it was like the Carolinas. And I heard this song, and again, I went up to the guy and I said, what on earth is this? You know, I would be a huge, incredible string band fan. And so anything that sounds kind of oddly folk with this kind of odd, strange melody, I'm immediately like, whoa, what? This sounds like people are really going out towards something. And I bought the record, and it turns out this is the only song I like. So in a way, I am going deep, but I'm not a fan of this guy, to be honest. But I love this song so much.
And that's Yandek there, and Nancy sings. It's kind of interesting that you would pick a piece of music and preface it by saying, I'm not a fan, but I love this.
Well, I don't mean to sort of knock him, but it's just I went deep into his records and I was really excited to go further because when I heard this song, I was like, wow.
No, but it seems like a simple thing to say, but actually it's never occurred to me before that you could actually not particularly like something, but they might have one song extra
and
special.
And he probably has more. I went deep into a few records and realised that there was nothing in it for me. That's not to say that it's not amazing for us.
Well, I think anybody, you know, go and check out Yandek because I think there's a film documentary about him as well and various other bits and pieces, but you should check him out. Glenn Hansard with me tonight picking all the music. We will be right back. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM. The Sunday special, tonight's guest picking all the music is Glenn Hansard. Glenn, that was Nico? Well, from a Nico album. Not sure who the kid was, but...
Yeah, me neither. It's from a record called Desert Shore. And I went kind of deep on Nico in the last couple of years after hearing a song called Frozen Warnings, which, again, would have been a great song to play on the show. But, it's a mammoth, kind of a long, deep one. You know, she's someone who I just, I'm absolutely, you know, they say with certain people's voices, you either love her or you don't. I just love her voice.
Yeah.
And I can listen to anything she sings.
I love her voice because much like Lou, she can't, inverted commas, sing at all.
Right.
Do you know what
right.
I mean?
It's very much her you're
she's
hearing.
She's not a singer.
Yeah. Well, they say that about Dylan, and he's probably my favourite singer.
Of course, yeah, it's a load of nonsense.
Yeah.
It's about putting a song across, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Really? Yeah. You mentioned just thinking about Nico and the Velvet Underground and all of that, were they, you know, everybody talks about them being a massive influence on bands in particular. And, you know, it's the cliched thing about thousands of bands were formed on the back of the Velvet Underground. But Keel always said they made themselves very hard to copy. And in fact, that's not true, you know.
Yes.
You couldn't play Velvet Underground songs that well. You could play Sweet Jane, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, what makes the Velvet Underground for me as a band is first of all, it's the songwriting. The songwriting, even when they're out there and they're just going for stuff, is just unbelievably crafted. I mean, they're amazing songwriters. I mean, Pale Blue Eyes is probably in the top five of greatest songs ever written.
Oh, we've got to play that.
We have to. I mean, it's just pure... In terms of, you know, we started the show by playing, just backtracking here a little bit, but we went with Father's Song by Unthanks, and then I believe we went into Bird on the Wire. And I think Pale Blue Eyes, in the same sense that Petit Chevalier, which we just heard, has this kind of nursery rhyme type of go-to-bed sort of spirit to it. And for me, I always feel like the great songs are the ones that either kind of have this exultant kind of prayer, like almost gospel, you know, gratitude in them, or they're songs to just fall to sleep with. And, you know, of course, my earliest memory of music and my earliest love of music was energetic music, was AC/DC. But in fact, there are so many modes, you know, there's music to go to battle to, there's music to wake up to, there's music to go to sleep to, and there's music to comfort. And so in a way, I sort of feel like once we have a good balance of all of this in our lives, in terms of, because, you know, the music we listen to is so broad. But I find that we're just noticing that we're on a kind of a path here with songs that are kind of, you know, simple melody.
Lullabies.
Lullabies, yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
And one of the greatest ones ever written.
There you go, Pale Blue Eyes from the Velvet Underground. Glenn Hansard in studio with me tonight, picking all the music. Now, we weren't going to play that, so what were we going to play?
We were going to play Padre Arrieta's Sport.
Yeah, but we got distracted by the Velvet Underground.
We went off.
Now, Sport, tell me about this. You probably know Padre, do you?
I know Padre. I got to know Padre in the last few years and a wonderful friend and an incredible artist and somebody that I've admired for a long, long time. I remember in probably 96, probably around then, Colm McInerney playing me Amidst These Hills, which was a record of Padre's, which you just can't find anywhere. I've tried to buy it. You just can't seem to get it anywhere. And he played me this song. And it was just again, one of those things that just hits you over the head. Just so beautiful, so simple, so wonderful. And just this idea of the being unprecious with your recording. Yeah. And I just found this to
be... And he records in the house.
Yeah.
And very often you can hear the fireplace crackle.
Exactly.
Or peacocks outside, or vervet monkeys, or whatever they have down there.
Exactly. And what's going on in Kool Aid. Absolutely. And I remember just really being so grateful that there was someone out there in the traditional world that wasn't necessarily looking for a clean recording, but who was embracing the sound of life all around them.
And another one of those artists who does his own thing.
He's completely his own man. And, you know, maybe we'll play another tune by him later on after this, because there's a record I'd really love to talk about of his.
Oh, we'll do that too. Well, let's play this one first. This is Sport. And again, a bit like the Nico track, there's a kid singing on this as well.
Yeah.
Michael Hartnett there. I tell you, Glenn, that was something out of the blue.
Yeah. Yeah. She was a song nobody sings. I mean, that line just absolutely guts me. I just recently came across his work in the last few years. My girlfriend Myra is a poet and she's a huge Hartnett fan. And she came from Finland going like, "Do you know Michael Hartnett?" And I was like, "No, actually, I don't." And so just the world that she, you know, the world that she is interested in, and she's got a huge grasp for Irish poetry. And it's been a great gold mine for me to discover Irish poetry through her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hartnett is really worth checking out. God. Yeah. And before Michael Hartnett, we had two tracks from Padraig O'Riordan from two different albums. That one immediately before it's from an album just called Piano, I think, is it?
Padraig O'Riordan on Piano is a record that I can honestly say for the last 2 years hasn't come off my CD player. I just play it constantly. Padder sent it to me. I didn't know anything about the record. He sent it to me and I read the sleeve notes and it's very ambitious. I mean, so Beethoven apparently wrote a bunch of tunes based on some Irish airs that were sent to him by another great composer who I can't remember right now, that were given to him and then he sent them to Beethoven. Beethoven wrote a bunch and apparently somewhere in his Fifth Symphony, there are echoes of this melody that he had taken from the Irish airs. And Padder, of course, being a kind of historian, had gone to the Beethoven people, the family or whoever, and gotten the books of Irish airs back and sat back down with them, re-voiced them back into the Irish airs, but keeping the accent of Beethoven in them, and made this two. So the first disc it's a double album. The first disc is just tunes Padder wrote for his family and, you know, just piano, solo piano tunes. And the second disc is more the Beethoven Irish airs.
Can we play one of those, Glenn?
We probably should.
Those Beethoven ones, yeah.
It's just incredible. I mean, we can go straight in.
Padraig O'Riordan there. And what's that track called? It's the first track on the second album.
Yeah, Poigín. Sorry, everybody who speaks Irish, but the
little Poigín kiss there.
Astorín, a kiss, dear maid.
Very good. And you were telling me that's Padder Beethoven, but I can hear the Last Rose of Summer in there as well. So it's all there. It's all going on.
I've bought like 40 copies of this record, and I'm not exaggerating. I've given them to all my friends. It's so one of
those
records.
That's that. I like that in people. You're kind of an evangelist when it comes to something you like.
I love it. I just want everyone to have it because, you know, people come and stay at my house a lot because, you know, we live a kind of a gypsy lifestyle, and that we're always in and out of the country, and people would come, and when we're not around, people stay in our house. And but this record is one of those ones. People are always like, "I love that. What is that record you play?" And you're like, well, great. It's great to be able to give it to them, you know. And Padder's been very generous. He sent me a bunch of copies. But recently we did a gig together in Dingle. And I noticed Padder was selling this CD and I bought every copy without him knowing because he wouldn't let me buy it otherwise.
Okay. All right. So your next choice, and we're moving genre here.
Well, just because it'd be nice to cover some more ground, I thought coming out of Padder might be nice to go into Gil Evans. Okay. And my memory of this song is standing on Grafton Street with Pete Short when he was selling in Dublin. And Pete occasionally would take off his headphones because he always seemed to be in a different world.
Yeah.
He would take off his headphones and put them in your ears and say, "Okay, listen to this." Like he was giving you a great piece of information. And I'll never forget hearing this for the first time.
Gil Evans, Las Vegas Tango. And that's Las Vegas Tango from Gil Evans. And it's the choice of Glenn Hansard is with me tonight picking all the music. That's quite something, isn't it?
What a tune. When that bass drops in, that groove is just unbelievable.
Do you pay much attention to jazz, Glenn?
A little bit. I mean, only in so much as the I kind of follow what moves me. And, sometimes you hear something and you just go, wow. It pulls you into a whole other world. So, of course, having Michael Buckley in your band, it's hard to avoid some of the great music that he tunes into too. It's been the last few years traveling with a proper horn section of guys who, have played with some heavyweights. You definitely get exposed to a lot of good stuff.
It'll do you no harm.
Yeah.
Baltimore is your next choice, Nina Simone. And it occurs to me this is a Randy Newman song.
Yeah.
And I don't think you've ever worked with him or met him, but he's kind of part of your world because of the Oscars and the movies and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, I suppose. Because somebody I really have grown to admire a lot more through the years. You know, the only thing I would have been exposed to when I was young would have been, You Got a Friend in Me or Short People
People.
But he's one of those artists that the more you hear of him, the more you realize, oh my God, it's a huge well.
Yeah. And he's an interesting approach to songs. I mean, The Simpsons, of course, you're in The Simpsons too, actually. But in The Simpsons, they have them out the backyard just making up songs like,
yeah,
I'm in the backyard. there's a tree. Anything. I mean, this is his song. And this is Nina doing a very souped up version of it too. Baltimore. And that's Nina Simone, her version of Baltimore. Glenn Hansard with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. Glenn, you're at this now a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Are you any closer to figuring out how it happens, how it works?
No, man. No, not at all. I still, when if I write a couplet and a guitar line or something on the piano and it works, I still get all of that same. That blood rush through me where I'm like, wow, this is really interesting. This is really good. And, I think at the end of the day, it's you live your life to write some good tunes. And that's really what a luxury to be able to give your life over in that way. Now, I work hard and, I travel and I work a lot, but I'm always really my work is to work for the song. I mean, that is the basis of it all. I mean, when a couple of good lines come out and you find yourself with the seeds of a song, there is no greater high.
Yeah,
it's really the greatest feeling. And sometimes finishing a song is a bit like killing it. Because the idea has all the potential, and then when you sign off on it, you kind of go, you're always a little disappointed in.
And what about that notion that the song is finished when somebody hears it? When it gets passed over.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I recently had the incredible experience of hearing a young man on Grafton Street singing my tune, and it was really one of those moments in where I was like, wow, I'm in
the middle. No, Henry Glenn, you must hear that quite a lot because the rest of us hear it all the time. When you're up and down Grafton Street, oh God, there's another one.
Oh, yeah, well, you're either being very kind or very smart, but I'll take either. No, I don't hear it very often at all. And when I did, it was actually kind of...
It must be great.
I had a quiet moment with myself where I was like, you're in the middle of a good life, man. This is kind of, because I started off playing songs of the people that moved me. And the fact that anyone would be doing that with my song in their throat is an incredible thing. And it's just a kind of a signifier, like a quiet signifier that you're on your path,
It's got to be. It's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah.
It's got to be. And to be part of the canon. The other thing that just again about that thing about passing the songs over, you do work hard and are very generous as a performer. You'll play long shows, you'll give the people what they want, you'll really put a lot of effort into that. And I want to ask you specifically, how significant was it that you saw Bruce Springsteen in the RDS that afternoon?
Oh my gosh! I mean, I was standing next to you.
Yeah,
I'll never forget it. And I couldn't figure out why the audience were booing him when he walked on. and you said, "No, Glenn, they're not booing. They're saying Bruce."
Yes, but the other part that I do recall is, as you now know, Springsteen gigs are long, and they go in various. But at more or less end of part one, you did literally say to me, "That's the best show I've ever seen." I said, "It hasn't even started yet."
I know.
Then the next time I saw you perform, you had moved up, to doing long very long, energetic shows, you know?
Well, I have to say that that gig had a massive effect on me. And when you see someone who's at the top of their game, everything changes. I remember calling Howard, my manager, afterwards, and I was like, right, you know, everything changes now. I got to get a horn section. I got to get a, you know, it's like boom, boom, boom. Yeah. I got to get this in place. Yeah. And, you know, there's nobody that gives as much as he does on stage. And of course, there are people, I'm sure, in the audience, if they come to see me play, who kind of go, well, I actually kind of would prefer if you did a shorter show of your, or if you didn't maybe talk so much, or if you didn't.
Yeah.
But you see, I learned pretty early on that whatever happens on stage is exactly what's meant to happen on stage. So the last thing I want to do is figure out my, you know, 16 song set and plow through it every night and, you know, and pay little regard to the city I'm in. I really believe that when you walk on stage, the one and only thing that you really have to bring, I've gone on stage without a voice. I've gone on stage where I've, half of my band haven't made the fly, you know. But the one thing that has happened is I've showed up. I'm present, and if I'm present, I know the gig will happen. So when I say present, I mean literally that I'm in my skin, that I'm standing there and going, "Hello, everybody. So here's the situation. My voice is trashed. I'm going to need you to sing every note with me because it's not there. We can make this work, or you can get your money back." But let's enter a pact here.
Yeah.
And so in a way, that's I really believe in that stuff. I really, you know, I've been to gigs where things have gone wrong and actually it ended up making the whole show, you know, and I really believe that that's the area Bruce is a master in. He really understands this whole thing of taking the placards out of the crowd and looking around at the band and going, 2, 3, 4. And it's like, boom, they're into the next song. I think that that's the magic of live music.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Next choice, Glenn.
Okay, I'd love to go for Bill Callahan, Faith Void. This is a song that Bill is just somebody who, you know, from through Smog and through his own career, like through Bill Callahan, it's all Smog, everything's been Bill Callahan. But somebody who I really would have admired very, very much, again, back at the beginning of the Frames, and somebody who would have had a big influence on me. And I've always kept an eye on his records, and I had the good fortune of touring with him in the last, I suppose, about 8 years ago. Very odd cat, really interesting guy, very interesting conversations, if you got any out of him, because he was very quiet. Yeah. But he's one of those guys that for me is like a modern great writer. He's one of those people that's just living and doing it quietly right now. He's not the guy that's on the big posters, he's not the guy that's getting all the attention, but he's definitely the guy that's influencing all those people, and one of the great writers of our time.
And that's Bill Callahan there. The choice of Glenn Hansard, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. We have time for just a couple of more tracks, Glenn. So where do you want to go after the mighty Bill Callahan?
Well, I'm going to stay with just music that I heard. You know, I was in Barcelona and I was on tour and I was in the MACBA. Is that how you say it? In the shop in the Museum of Modern Art there.
Oh, right, right,
in Barcelona. And I heard a song again on the speakers, and I went up to the lady behind the desk and I asked her what it was, and she told me it's a band called El Perro del Mar. And the song was called How Did We Forget? And I remember taking it down and thinking they must be a Spanish band because El Perro del Mar, and we're in Barcelona. And it turns out they're from Sweden. But this song, I just really moved me. And this is something so wonderfully simple and catchy and great about
and
this.
You just heard this playing on the speakers?
Heard it playing on the speakers, and I went and I found the record.
Great. That's the way to do it. Oh, Glenn, you have outdone yourself. That was a gorgeous, gorgeous song.
It's a killer tune, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just great. Simplicity. Well, it's not simple, but you know,
it takes great confidence to be that simple.
It's gorgeous, that. And that's El Perro...
What? Del Mar.
El Perro del Mar, How Did We Forget? That you heard on a speaker system in a Barcelona gallery.
Yeah, and I asked the girl behind the counter and she was very happy to share it with me. She was listening to the record.
Well, I'll be getting that one later myself. That's a cracker. You brought in some great stuff tonight, Glenn. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
And... you know, if anybody was expecting the biographical interview, I'm glad we didn't do it.
Me too.
Just
me
rambled
too.
On.
It's great to play music. I mean, it's really the greatest gift. It's the greatest job you have, Do you know, it's the one thing, if I wasn't a singer, it's the one thing I think I'd really love to do is to be a DJ, but not in the context that I'd have to play this and that and the other. You know, one of the things I really always really admired about yourself and Donald Deneen is that whether you have a job or whether you don't, you've always played the music you want to play.
All right. Yes. So your last choice, actually, before you play your last choice, what can you tell us? The album is a cracker. I've heard it. It's out. It's been delayed thanks to Brian May, but it's now available.
Yeah.
What's it called again, the album title?
It's called This Wild Willing.
This Wild Willing. And it's a cracking record. Will you tour here on the back of it? Will you be in Ireland?
I will. I'll play in April. I'll do two nights in Vicar Street. I just really like that venue. I really like the people behind us. The promoters are great. Aikens. Do two nights here and then go off into Europe and America and Australia and all the rest, and it'll be a long, and I'm excited about it because there's nothing like touring a record you're proud of.
Yeah, and I know you tour a lot, Glenn. You're still up for that? Absolutely up for it.
I am when I believe in that what we're doing is not, you know, because the last thing you want to be doing is going out there and just peddling some version of what you think is yourself or what you do. I just happen to feel very, you know, very in touch with the music I'm making right now, and that's a huge thing. When you're not, the tour drags on, and you're not really sure what you're doing. And you know, I've kind of changed the clientele in the band a bit, only because that's a nice introduction to the next song. But you know, I've had a great band for the last few years, an amazing band with horns and strings, and I do feel the need now to shuffle it up a bit. I'm going to take the Persian musicians out with me and see what we get. I mean, I have to figure out how to play this record. But
yeah, because the songs were improvised on the record.
They're improvised, and so I need to figure out a version of these songs for the stage. And, you know, that will be a challenge. And then also it'll lead to new songs. So it's for me, playing with musicians that I don't necessarily know that well is always a great challenge, because it means that I can, it means that I'm performing to them as much as they're performing to the audience, or vice versa.
Keep you on your toes.
Absolutely.
Glenn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Good of you to spare the time. Always good to see you. And your last choice is?
I'm going to play, you know, for a band called The Clientele, who I saw live with Martin Fink in probably 95 in Boston. They were playing in the Paradiso. Great band. Just loved them. English band. And I was just a huge fan of the sound they made. Again, it kind of reminded me a little bit of where the Velvet Underground were at a certain point in their career. And this is just a band I just have always loved and I've always kept up with. And they're not really that well known, but this song, Reflections After Jane, is one of those songs that puts me in a real Sunday morning mood. I just get a real sense of the world's all right, and, you know, put on your coat and get out there and shuffle through your day.
Cheers, Glenn. The Clientele, Reflections After Jane. Thanks, Glenn.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.